I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me a chance to speak. This talk will be based on two papers, one by Gary Horowitz and me, an advisor and me, and the other by Keith Copsey and Robert Mann. So, dense matter. One often finds fixed points. And these fixed points have what's called a dynamical scaling. And this just means that there is a scaling symmetry where time scales differently than space. Where the z is called a dynamical scaling exponent. So we would like to make holographic duals to such a system. So how do we go about doing that? Well, one idea is to impose additional symmetries, such as rotational invariance, translations, time reversal, and parity. And this was work done by Shami Katru and some other authors. And this will lead us to the following line element. And this is often called a Lipschitz metric, or Lipschitz spacetime, because they describe Lipschitz-like fixed points. And this metric will satisfy the scaling relation if, in addition, we also scale r as 1 over lambda. As we have mentioned in the program before, this metric likes to show up in the IR limit of finite density systems. There are two special cases to this metric. One is where z equals 1. And this just corresponds to the usual ADS metric in Poincaré coordinates. And the scaling symmetry is just the usual conformal scaling. The other special case corresponds when z goes to infinity. With some work, you can show that the metric becomes an ADS2 and some flat direction. And the scaling symmetry becomes such that time scales, but space does not. What we'd like to do is to understand the far IR of this Lipschitz spacetime. So I go. And in the way that I have written this metric, the IR limit corresponds to r goes to 0.
What about z less than 1?
Pardon?
What about z less than 1?
Z less than 1.
For example, z equals 0 also looks special.
I think z has to be bigger than 0 for this to make sense.
Bigger than 0?
Can you make a metric of smear zero rings that does that in a way that is the size of the x squared term?
I'm not sure there's a, I mean, there's not a full scale assumption, but it can happen, but.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, what is the pathology you have in mind?
Sorry.
What is the pathology you have in mind?
Wednesday. I just haven't seen anybody talk about it, but that doesn't mean it can't be considered.
It's funny that I don't think in field theory it's very easy to make an argument why C. I mean, people consider C larger than one, but I don't know of any clean, very obvious field theory argument why a theory is C less than one. And again, because you were making this point about special plus, C equals zero is also very special.
Sure.
And it doesn't seem like a bad metric, obviously. I mean, it's R times ABS.
I mean, I do think there are some metrics where the T and S go off.
I mean, it's funny that T equals zero is okay. Why small T is not okay?
No, there's probably no good reason to take Z out other than the fact that most people consider Z being one. Okay, so we want to understand the IR limit of Lipschitz. So what does general relativity have to say about that limit of this method? General relativity says that all the curvature scalars of this metric are constant, so there's no divergence. But on the other hand, the tidal forces diverge. To see this, we consider some freely falling observer into R equals zero. In other words, we want a geodesic with some tangent that only goes in the radial direction. We might as well assume it's time-like. We want to set up some orthonormal frame that follows what such an observer would see. So for the time-like basis vector, we can just choose this tangent, where E is just some conserved energy based on this Killing field. And the R dot component we can just solve from the time-like constraint. We can also set up the transverse component just from taking the square root of the metric. And together, these form the components of a parallelly propagating orthonormal frame along this geodesic.
Can I ask you something?
Yes.
So this divergence of tidal forces, this is some local measure of pathology in this background. So this divergence that never shows up in any curvature theory.
That's right. In this
these backgrounds are, valid string theory backgrounds, which is obvious weight. So, and if they have these kind of pathologies, then you would think that adding some local corrections to this, which comes from string theory, adding to the possible action is not going to cure these kind of problems. So, what sort of resolution to this pathology do you have in mind when you consider this in terms of string theory?
That will actually pretty much be the subject of my talk, so hang on. I will talk about that in further detail. Okay, so as is mentioned, all the curvature scalars that you can possibly compute from this metric will be finite. But if you compute the curvature for such an observer falling into R equals zero, you will find that it diverges. that the curvature diverges as argosies go. Of course, there's a special case when z equals 1. We just have ADS, and this singularity is merely a coordinate singularity for the Poincaré path. So that's what GR has to say.
Going to Diego's question, wouldn't that tell you something funny that happens if z is less than 1?
It still diverges whether or not you have z being less than 1.
No, but the sign will change. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, so they'll act in... The tidal forces will act in a different direction.
It's connected in spin.
That will actually have consequences for string when I discuss that later.
Okay,
so moving on. What does string theory have to say about this? Well, string theory, I think, offers three modifications. The first thing is alpha prime corrections. So if you...
Is the Ricci tensor singularity?
The Ricci tensor, probably not, because it just comes from Einstein's equations. For the Ricci tensor, you can just write down Einstein's equations. And if this satisfies Einstein's equations, it shouldn't have any...
This satisfies
Yeah, basically. With some appropriate matter that satisfies that.
Yeah, so the matter could also
be. I think the matter is well behaved.
So this isn't the only component of the matter.
There are other components that would diverge, and some of them are finite, but we only need one to show that it's a singularity.
If you're sure that it's not the divergent source.
No, it's not the matter. It's definitely.
What is the matter that gives
rise to this? There are several. You can do this with a massive vector or some dilaton.
Dilaton that does what?
In that case, I think it's a running. Is it a running dilaton?
So it could also diverge?
The dilaton could diverge, right? I think for the massive vector, everything is fine.
What is it though?
It's just some function. I don't think it has any singularity. Okay. So one thing that strings offer are alpha prime corrections that are corrections to the curvature. But if you demand that we keep all these symmetries, all that could really happen with alpha prime corrections is that the ADS length, that these alpha prime corrections can only renormalize the ADS radius and z. The ADS radius, which I have implicitly set to be 1 in my metric.
Why is it?
It's just you have enough symmetry here. We're keeping all of these symmetries. And in doing so, the only thing that could really happen is that these two get changed. So if you allow these things to be changed, this is no longer true. So that could be an out, that we are keeping too many symmetries in the Lipschitz case. Second thing that could happen in strings is that we should be considering higher dimensions. I know of mainly two classes of higher dimensional embeddings, one of which you'll probably hear Koshik talk more about. These look roughly of this form. This is for z equals 2. F is some function of this sigma coordinate, which we can take to be periodic. and E is just some metric for Sasaki-Einstein manifold, and gamma is just some constant. If F happens to be a constant, we can just take a Kalutza-Klein reduction and recover this Lipschitz metric. If it's not, you can still argue that on wavelengths much larger than this circle, this metric should look something like Lipschitz. Another class of higher dimensional solutions are these warp products. And these are just products where Lipschitz gets scaled by some other coordinate in the other space. But you can compute the same tidal forces for either of these types of solutions, and you find that they also diverge.
Labels in 10 or 11 dimensions, or what's the?
10 or 11.
10 or 11.
Yeah, I think they're all in 10 or 11. So the tidal forces also diverge for these solutions. Third thing, that strings do for you.
Do all the string theory solutions involve remote dimensions?
Yeah. I think some of them do and some of them don't. I'm not sure though. Okay. So the third thing that strings offer. I'll call this string propagation. And strings are extended objects, so that just because a space-time is singular in the sense of general relativity doesn't mean that they'll also be singular in the sense of string theory. Take, for example, orbifold space-times. They are geodesically incomplete, but acceptable within string theory. So maybe we can resolve this singularity by throwing strings to it and see what happens. So this was a question that was asked of us early in this program. So after thinking about it a little bit, we noticed two things. The first of which is that the Lipschitz singularity is a null singularity. The way to see this is that if it's not, say take a time-like singularity, then any outgoing null light ray could lie entirely in the future of some incoming null light ray. But from the metric, you can see that null light rays will do this. And so time goes to infinity as r goes to 0. So this is not possible. So the only other possibility is that the singularity is null. So indeed, the conformal diagram looks something like this. The other observation is that as we go into the singularity, there's still translational symmetry. I just erased the metric. No, you still have translational symmetry, right?
No, I'm mistaken with the singularity.
Yeah, I don't think it's true. Yeah, then this thing goes on top and there's no singularity anymore. So those two observations might lead you to think that the space-time looks something like a plane wave. So I'm going to now show you explicitly that it does look like a plane wave. And you do this by performing the following coordinate transformations. And then the metric that you get is as follows. Of course, we want small r. So small r corresponds to u being much bigger than v. So we can approximate this metric by eliminating these v terms if we only consider about this, if we only consider this metric for small r. And we have a plane wave. With a little more work, you can show that this metric becomes
So for small r, being small,
it implies that u must be much larger than v, right? Simply from this Schwarzschild transformation. And so you look at all these u minus v terms and they go to v. Okay. And then we have some line element, which we can then take some more coordinate transformations and get into a more familiar plane wave form. Where this w is given by and for reference, the old r is related to the u, the new u, by this relation.
So
v
can't be negative?
No, v can't be negative. It depends on which piece of the space-time you're looking at. Plane waves are nice because people have studied strings going across singularities and plane wave backgrounds back in the 90s. So we can more or less just read off the results. In particular, we use the paper by DeSanchez and De Vega and Sanchez. So to study test strings, we want to compute the string world sheet in some Polyakov action. And the great thing about a plane wave is that you can choose a gauge where the equations of motion split very nicely. Yes, just a test string flowing in this pattern. So we can split x into modes, where this x10 now satisfies a Schrödinger-like equation. And the remaining component b, a coordinate, the is just found by integrating x. So here we have a Schrödinger equation with some energy n squared and some potential given by w. And the dynamics of these strings actually depend very much on the sign of this potential, at least for the potential that we have. So there are mainly two cases. So there's z less than 1, in which case this potential is repulsive. And what happens is that the strings propagate out to infinity in finite time, at least in the transverse direction. So x goes to infinity as z goes to 0, which corresponds to r going to 0. And it does so in finite times, so the strings never really make it to the singularity. Well, it's just a u squared. So for this case, it looks something like.
So you'd use negative and positive?
Yeah. Depending on whatever z is, this can go up or down. The critical z will be z equals 1, which is just ADS.
Remember that?
For minus a quarter, you would want what z equals.
But I think he demanded the energy. I mean, he's got that n squared. So that somehow you're looking at he's demanding a certain spectrum.
These are just the string modes. We will eventually take n to be some large number if we want to see what happens to this to the highest string modes as the string propagates. It's plus it's this if z is less than 1, and it's minus that if z is greater than 1. So if z is less than 1, this is positive, and z is bigger than 1. Oh, I'm sorry. There should be a minus there. Thank you. So it might make sense sometimes to introduce a cutoff so that the string goes out to this cutoff at some finite time, and then later on it might just continue propagating. That's pretty much the only way I know of to make sense of this.
These words you're using apply in the WKP.
This equation you can actually solve in terms of Bessel functions. Okay. And if you look at the solution close to the singularity, you find that these x's diverge, or this z. Okay, so the string as it gets close is being pushed away by this potential off to infinity.
So as
u goes to 0, or as r goes to 0, so u goes to 0 is simply just this tau.
Are we solving a scaling problem, or is this a, is there time in this thing?
The time here would be tau. Okay, so you're looking at some regularly infalling string.
Is it the proper time along the string?
Yeah. That goes along this null coordinate. It's a null coordinate. Okay.
So the ADS, there are some modes that get to the boundary in finite time, right?
Yeah. But this isn't the boundary. This is the transverse direction going to infinity. So the strings sort of just get really far away, and then we have to worry about what happens to them afterwards.
You mean to get really far away, or to get really large?
They get really large, essentially.
So this is the expectation value of the length of the string. But this is just an endpoint.
Yeah, yes. So points on the string are getting are becoming very far away in the transverse direction.
And it's oscillating like that.
Yeah, and it's oscillating like that.
All the xn.
Yeah. So one, what happens after this? Okay. So in the other case, z is bigger than 1. This potential is now attractive. So let's draw it here. And it hits the singularity. since it does that, we can ask the question, if the strings get infinitely excited when they do so. So to do this, we cut off the potential at some large tau. This is W of choice. And out here, the solution is just strings propagating in flat space. So these modes just split into the usual exponentials. And they do the same thing here. So to distinguish these two, I'll put them less than. And here we just swap. These are each complete sets. So they're related to each other by the Bogolyubov transformation.
So now you're assuming that the string can propagate.
Yes, we're assuming that it can go through. We want to see what happens to the modes. As the string goes through, and for that we need flat space. We need a flat space on either end. So the expectation value of the mass operator can be related to this mode B, or this coefficient B. And the number operator is also similarly related. And given a solution to strings going through here, you can solve for this coefficient. This Fn is just a solution with a specific boundary condition, namely that it approaches the positive exponent for tau being very much in the past. I didn't catch that.
What is the boundary condition?
Oh, yeah. We assume the solution here is the same as the solution here. And, well, we have some boundary condition on this edge, which is just this mode. For that f, we only assume that it has this specific coefficient. Right? So we turn off this mode, far pass. Okay? We propagate it in. We match the conditions in the middle. We use the standard matching conditions. And we see what happens later.
The shape of this potential around tau equal to zero is not the way it's been drawn, right?
Sorry, what?
The shape of the potential that's in that region is not infinitely deep.
It is infinitely deep.
But here, to write down what W is, you made an approximation to be around r equal to zero. Maybe I'm misunderstanding from you.
So
and for that, you have to take u much, much bigger than
v.
And is that why you get that infinity of the potential then? Is that approximation?
The approximation
is near r equal to zero. So that means that that means that it's not valid around u equal to zero.
No, it should be valid to u.
There's another coordinate transformation.
Yeah, there's a. Yeah.
I see. They're actually looking close to.
Okay.
So what are the matching conditions then, the singularity?
I think you just match the function and its derivative. What you can do is put a cutoff here and do that and then just send this cutoff down.
And now back to John's question. That potential makes sense for every value of this strength of this infinite potential? Because I think there are bounds, right?
Things get worse as z equals 2.
But this approximation should hold for any z, as long as you're close to.
I'm not arguing with your question. Okay. I'm just saying potentially the Schrodinger expansion that you had requires a self-adjoint expansion of z equals 2.
Okay.
And I think for
z, why is that? The coefficient is actually maximized at z equals 2, then it's a quarter, which is funny.
It becomes minus a quarter at z equals 2. But you're saying it gets smaller again?
Yeah.
Oh, you're talking about this coefficient here? Oh, yeah, that coefficient probably goes negative down to minus a quarter.
Oh, I see. So then it's always okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I see. So then, but then why does anything go negative?
No, because there's still a 1 over u squared. This is just what happens to the coefficient in front of the one that was on
the
u-squared.
The coefficient less than a quarter, it's self-adjoint.
I think so. But there's still a singularity, so things could happen to the string. Well, okay. Maybe I should continue. Okay, so if we take the Schrodinger equation and we divide by n squared and then scale out tau, we find that any solution can be written in terms of the solution for one mode, for the one mode, and then scaling out tau. So when we put that in there, we find that for any of these coefficients, the answer actually becomes independent of n. So this is independent of n, which means that for any n, every one of these coefficients is going to be the same. So when we put them in here, these diverge. The one exception, or the two exceptions, is that this coefficient is 0 when z goes to 1, or when z equals 1, and when z goes to infinity. So these are the two limits. When we have ADS and ADS plus large 2. So to summarize, if z is less than 1, these strings get pulled very far away in the transverse directions. And for z bigger than 1, the string hits the singularity and becomes infinitely excited.
So what's the difference between those two? I mean, when you say in the first part,
in the first part, it never makes it to the singularity. It gets pushed to infinity before that happens.
Stretching out an x, maybe.
Yeah. So for. No, because here it's not being stretched apart.
Wait, it's oscillating wildly, which means different parts of the string are.
Yes, it is. It is oscillating very wildly, but here it's all being pushed towards the origin, so it's.
But it is stretching out an x in both cases.
It is, but it's stretching out way, way more here.
Wait, but here you're saying it also diverges. What?
Here I'm saying that when it goes through the singularity, it becomes infinitely excited.
But that also.
So these modes go and diverge.
Right, but that means that the string is infinitely large.
There are higher mode excitations in the string, right? So every string has many, many modes. So it means that the higher modes are being equally excited as the lower mode, so it has an infinite amount of energy.
Well, but that.
There is each mode.
But usually there's a random walk statement that the size of the string is like the square root of the. Just an ordinary flat space.
Yeah, but in the first case, he was dealing with each mode.
Okay, but I'm just saying, is the, so there's a difference between the two cases, but
yeah, I think
it's also true in the second case that the string is getting into the stretch.
I think the difference is that these are sort of the external degrees of freedom for the string, because it's just a string moving in space-time, but these are the internal oscillations of the string.
Yeah, but if you're serious at one point, you get
The expectation value of x squared is diverging in both cases. But I have a slightly different question too, which is that all of this is happening in a very redshifted part of the system.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this string that's getting very stretched, but it's also highly redshifted down. So I remember in your paper you described this as a huge instability, but I'm not clear on whether that's...
It's instability because when you have some string going towards a singularity, it would probably back react from the metric.
So you want to think this is a bad thing?
Yes. Okay, so if it's back reacting on the metric, it probably means that the metric's unstable, because you take any string from the outside and you throw it in, and the spacetime gets highly warped. I think the Sanchez ended. Yes, I think the Vega and Sanchez did that, and they find.
I mean, the energy is conserved in the field theory, so whatever energy you started with, that's what this thing has.
Yes.
It's gone down to the bottom of the warp throat and started. You
know. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, things are okay.
They don't receive any corrections because it's only R plus plus.
That's
the only part of the GTN, so that's non-zero. So whatever corrections that you write, I mean, there are exact solutions to all of this in top prime. And there are singular limits of black holes, right? You boost a black hole and you scale the mass, you get the wave solutions. And there might be this infinite excitation, but that's just a reflection of the singular limit that you're taking on a physical configuration. That doesn't mean there's anything wrong with the solution. It just means that you grab something that makes sense and you boost it a lot, so things start diverging. And you don't expect them to be corrected. They're in principle good solutions.
They're not corrected by alpha prime, but if you study some sort of string dynamics, you probably expect the space time to back.
I agree, but the question is whether you should be troubled. I don't disagree with the result of your calculation. The question is whether you should be troubled by this or not.
I think maybe because we haven't had the talk, we
okay. I'm finished.
If you should state the conclusion, should be allowed to state the conclusion.
I guess the conclusion is that we expect that Lifshitz to be unstable. And when it's unstable, it probably breaks all of the usual symmetries that we have had. So it's not in contradiction with the non-renormalizability theorem. That is a theorem that only L and Z get changed by alpha prime corrections.
Do you mean that if we start with the Lifshitz solution with nothing, that it's that there's a tachyon that makes it?
I don't think it's a tachyon.
But unstable, you mean sensitive to higher order gravitational correction.
Yeah, it's sensitive to strings. The string mode being excited and back reacting on the metric.
Yes,
but they will not respect the symmetries that are used in the non-renormalizability theorem.
How do you conclude that?
Well, the theorem says that if you keep rotational invariance, translational invariance, and the scaling symmetry, all that could happen is that L and Z get rescaled. And those are also Lifshitz, which also suffers from this type of instability. So if it's to evolve to anything, it can't be another Lifshitz. But I don't know what the endpoint is.
We can then carry on talking later.
Okay.
Let's talk about the flushing now. Let's say fancy.